Good morning, everyone. We're going to start out with a Cheyenne spiritual song on page 24 of Sing the Journey. Okay, creation is a song. This song was given to Maud Fighting Bear. Okay, and so Tyler is going to play it first in pure flute. It's going to be pure flute the first time, and then we'll all join in, okay, and sing all the verses.
Good to be gathered today as part of our two-day series on dismantling the doctrine of discovery. And in just a little bit, Erica Littlewolf will be bringing us a presentation on replacing ourselves. And I took that, this is the second time we've had campus speakers who have asked us to reconsider our place. Todd Winward was the first, as he was teaching about watershed discipleship. Do we know where we are and our relationship with the land and with the peoples who have been in this place? So you used to enjoy hearing the one-minute naturalist on public radio. I'm giving the two-minute historian version of replacing ourselves. So the Shenandoah Valley stretches 200 miles between two mountain ranges, the Blue Ridge Mountains to the east, the Allegheny Mountains to the west, part of the Appalachian Mountain Range to the west, as well as the Potomac River to the north and the James River to the south. We are in the Black's Run watershed, which is part of the Shenandoah River watershed, which is part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, replacing ourselves. four centuries ago, before this story of settlement, and we often start here, a lot of us, when Europeans, mostly of German or Irish Scottish descent, came down the valley from Pennsylvania. It's the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road. That's where many of us start the story of the settling of the Shenandoah Valley. But four centuries ago, when all of America was Virginia, sort of, this is a resource from firstsettlersshenandoahvalley.com history. So the telling is slanted, if you will, or focused. The Shenandoah Valley, a fertile and bountiful 200-mile natural thoroughfare formed by ancient oceans, was the site of old legends and revered tales. Native Americans detailed to the first Englishmen arriving on American soil in the 1600s of vast herds of grazing animals and endless forests of American trees, including chestnut trees, many 600 years old and 100 feet high here in the valley. For thousands of years, the American Indians, Native Americans, had thrived in the bountiful Shenandoah Valley hunting ground, later trading highly valued furs to be worn in Europe. Now, such an abundance of pristine land and game was not to go unnoticed back in England, still in the 1600s, where young Lord Fairfax, there's a name we might recognize from Northern Virginia, a court favorite of King Charles I and the Second, had just become heir of 5,282,000 acres of land in Virginia. Not sure how that happens from the courts of England, that someone is made heir to that much of land in Virginia, including what's now the Shenandoah Valley. Lord Fairfax, residing in regal splendor in his comfortable abode in England, heard about a German explorer in the 1670s who told that the Shenandoah Valley was, quote, wonderfully fertile, with grass so tall that the tops could be tied together in front of your chest as you sat on your saddle. Other explorers in the intervening years brought back similar tales. Who was here before this settlement, right? Here's a convenient recalling of history for the adventurous Europeans, mostly of German, Scot-Irish descent. Any holes in this? By the early 1700s, when the first European explorers entered the valley, there were no longer Native Americans living in the valley. Several tribes used the valley still, I think, as hunting grounds, among them the Shawnee, Iroquois, I'm not sure of this one, Okanichi, Monacans, and Piscataways, but no tribes laid claim to the land. Sounds pretty convenient. Therefore, it's ours, right? Also earlier, it could be that there were some Powhatans living here, and perhaps even Cherokee at some point. We want to honor these native peoples today as we have Erica speak to us about replacing ourselves. The Shawnee, Iroquois, Okanichi, Monacans, Piscataways, Powhatan, and perhaps Cherokee tribes. Erica, we're glad you're here today. Erica is Northern Cheyenne from southeastern Montana, currently living in Kansas. She works for Mennonite Central Committee, U.S., the Central States region, with the Indigenous Visioning Circle, where she is committed to the work of decolonization, authentic relationship, and healing. She is here with Karen Kaufman Wall. Together tonight at 7, they will lead a participatory workshop, a simulation called The Loss of Turtle Island. We hope you'll come and bring your friends. We need 50 to 75 people for it to be ideal. Thank you for being here. Let's welcome Erica to the stage.
Well, Tama Pivamont Dine, one hat na dinchive, Natistas. Good morning. I got corrected on my Cheyenne by an elder last week because I used slang Cheyenne, and so I actually said the formal Cheyenne for the first time. But good morning. I'm Erica Littlewolf. I'm Northern Cheyenne from southeastern Montana. I currently live in Kansas. The title of this is Replacing Ourselves and Modern Day Realities and Where Do We Go From Here? And I usually have a standard way of sharing until I came across this article, and it's fabulous. It's written by James Treat, and he's an enrolled member of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. And the title of it is The Canaanite Problem. And I tend to not use the Bible. I'm 35 years old, and I have never found a way of connecting to the Bible until just last week when I was introduced to this verse and the connections he has made. I have read these verses before and had different interpretations, and I really like the parallels he makes. And so I'm going to share from this article he has written and preface that I'm not a Bible expert, and so I'm learning just like everyone else. So what he does, a little background is to the verse on the promised land. And this is one of the main verses that was used in the doctrine of discovery, that the land was, in the terms of the doctrine of discovery, that if the Christians came over and there were no Christians on the land, then they could take the land and clear out the lands, because even if people were there and they were pagan people, they weren't considered human. And so the verse used to justify this is the promised land verse in the Bible. And so this is the preface to what I'm going to share out of Matthew. And this Bible verse comes out of Matthew 15, 21 through 28. It says, "Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, 'Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession.' Jesus did not answer a word, so his disciples came to him and urged him, 'Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us.' He answered, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel.' The woman came and he knelt before them. 'Lord, help me,' she said. He replied, 'It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs.' 'Yes, Lord,' she said, 'but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table.' Then Jesus answered, 'Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted.' And her daughter was healed from that very hour." And this author, James Treat, challenges us to look at this verse through the lens of indigenous people, which would be the Canaanites in this story. And when he lays it out, he parallels this to the native history. And so his article titled The Canaanite Problem, he parallels it with the Indian problem in what is current day the United States. And he says we need to imagine this story through different eyes and to see the whole ways in which people enter into this story in order to bring reconciliation to natives and non-native people. And he said this is the Indian problem is a social, political, ethical, and theological problem for Native people today. And it's always been. We can see this through the residential schooling system where Christianity brought boarding schools with the slogan of "Kill the Indian, save the man." And so the modern thought in Christianity today is that you become a Christian and you lose your Native identity, or you stay a Native and you cannot become a Christian. And so it's interesting to look at this article. And we tend to want to look at it in that lens of how I just framed it as an either-or reality. You're either Christian or you're Native. And this article challenged us to look at it, that what does it look like to tell these stories from both angles? What does it look like to look at Scripture from a Canaanite point of view? And when he says we look at this from the Canaanite point of view, we start looking at this as a story of invasion, of a story of dispossession and a story of slavery. And so when we look at that verse through that lens, in the article he goes through and he talks about how as Christians reading it from a dominant perspective, when we read this article, we tend to want to say, oh, maybe Jesus was just having an off day. Or we tend to say, maybe he was concerned, but he was busy. He had just fed all these people, and he had all these things to do. And when I read this verse, I thought, thank God Jesus is human for once. And I think that's where I connect. And we've debated this verse over many conversations, which is foundational to Anabaptist ways of doing things. And it's interesting because sitting in a table, people tend to want to say that, Jesus is having an off day. And I raise my hand and I'm like, no, I like it. It shows like he's human. And it was interesting to me to know that he passed off a Canaanite who is a woman. They mentioned she's a woman. And yet this article lays out the foundation to me of what a new Christian reality may look like for Native people. He says the woman comes to him not asking to be changed, not asking to believe his religion, but she comes to him out of faith. Like her pure faith was what she needed. And so what does that faith look like for Native people? Does it have to come through the use of a piano instead of a drum? Does it have to come through English instead of our traditional languages? Does it have to come in Western dress versus our traditional dress? These are things I think about when I read his article. And so the reality for Native people, as I've stated, in the Christian world is that we have to give up who we are. There's been theologians such as Richard Twist, Terry LeBlanc, Cheryl Bear, that have investigated and questioned what it means to be Christian and Native. And so I really like using this verse from Matthew. And also the writer actually goes on to mention that this is the only place in the New Testament that the Canaanites are mentioned. And so that's interesting. It's like everyone wants to get rid of the Indian problem, and it shows up in the New Testament that the Canaanites are still alive. And I tend to think that everyone would be happy if the natives were just dead. And the reality is we're still alive. And so there's been theologians looking at this, and I'm interested in further looking at this. I'm interested in conversation because this is directly how the church has imposed the doctrine of discovery on Indigenous people in the U.S., on Indigenous people in Canada, and Indigenous people around the world. And my thoughts aren't fully developed on this yet, but this is what I have to offer, and I highly recommend this article. It's phenomenal. Once again, it's The Canaanite Problem by James Treat, and he's from the Muscogee Creek Nation. And he also mentions Robert Allen Warrior with a book, Canaanites, Cowboys, and Indians. And this is fabulous work. And I also invite you this evening to our exercise. And I'm sure I've created a lot of questions and haven't answered them. And that's kind of my preferred way of sharing. thank you.
Erica and Karen will be in a couple classes today that are open to visitors from 11:40 to 12:30, the Exploring Social Work class. And that's in Library 303, Melody Pinnell's class. And 12:40 to 1:30, Globalization and Justice, Peter Dula's class, in Science Center 104. You can check with me afterward if you want to go to those and you forgot where they are. Those are open to the public, and then 7 o'clock this evening as well. They'll be here to talk a bit afterward, and Carol and Tyler will lead us in one more song.
Thank you.
is another form of prayer. If you have time now, or later today, or perhaps tomorrow, check out the panels, the Doctrine of Discovery panels that are in the Campus Center on display. They'll be taken down on Friday. They tell the story, key points, of how this doctrine has impacted policies and procedures through the years. And if you don't have a chance to be in a classroom, engaging those panels is very helpful. And if you don't have time to read them, then take photos and take them with you over spring break. Go in peace.